Oh, it's hump day, which is like bump day for the week.
It's Wednesday. It's Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jordan. That's Jake. We're talking about the Baltimore Orioles. We're talking about the New York Yankees and Aaron Boone's epic ability to get ejected no matter what is happening in his dugout and so much more.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows that the Nationals may have cherry blossom uniforms, but what they really need is pollen uniforms. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and I am in the nation's capital getting absolutely blasted into submission by a tsunami of pollen.
Oh, man, I know that feeling well. Hasn't been as bad. My Claritin's been taking care of me here in the Midwest, but I know exactly the feeling that you are having. This is prime time right now. This is really mid-April is when you are just getting just smushed by that floaty stuff in the air. It sucks.
And, you know, I'm headed to Nats Park today to see the Dodgers and Shohei Ohtani, and I am excited to see if Ohtani is truly impervious. You know, he is a superhero in many respects, but can he withstand the pollen in the air? You know, I think that people from places are generally biased and kind of hyperbolic about where they're from and its qualities. Like, dude, Knoxville, Tennessee traffic, like, you don't understand.
Yes.
But I do genuinely believe that Washington, D.C. area pollen.
D.C. pollen. It's nothing like it, man.
You just undefeated.
Kinda, well, it sounds like, okay, Ohtani sneeze watch is in full effect. Keep an eye on that. See if he's itching those eyes. We will keep an eye on that for sure. He looked okay last night when he hit a ball 118 miles an hour for a home run into the second deck.
The hardest hit home run of his career.
Yes, yes. Kind of surprised me because I feel like he's rattling off, you know, 117s, 118s on the reg. Jake, on this episode, we are going to talk about your Baltimore Orioles. We are going to talk about not our New York Yankees. And then we'll see what we have time for. But we have to talk about Aaron Boone's ejection, and we have to talk about some Baltimore Orioles discourse that has kind of filtered onto our timeline that we wanted to respond to and kind of dig into. Do you want to start with the Orioles or do you want to start with Aaron Boone?
Let's start with Aaron Boone because it's so funny. Yes. It's so freaking funny.
Yes.
Can you give us a play-by-play here of Aaron Boone's Monday ejection?
Yes.
At the hands of the evil Hunter Wendelstadt.
Yes, yes. I imagine most people have seen this by now, but here's the short version. Very beginning of the game, Carlos Rodon is on the mound. He throws a literal backfist slider to Estre Ruiz that hits him on the foot. Estre Ruiz maybe swings, maybe doesn't. John Tompain, the third base ump, says yes, he did swing. He didn't swing. So he is awarded first base with a hit by pitch. Aaron Boone is not happy about that. He's like, what the heck? Probably said other things than what the heck. And Hunter Wendelstadt, the home plate ump, says he immediately basically gives a warning to the Yankees dugout two pitches into the game. Be like, stop complaining. Like, we can't be doing this all day. I believe three pitches later, there is a noise emitted from the right, from the first base side. As for who emitted the noise, who's to say? We'll get to that. We are to say because there's very clear video. Aaron Boone is just standing there thinking about his team and thinking about DJ LeMahieu's foot and whether he's ever going to play this season. And he's just standing there, just being a manager, just standing there, being Aaron Boone. And Hunter Wendelstadt looks over and hears something and says, Aaron Boone, you are gone. Upon video review, every angle that the YES Network gave us, it sure looks like what has happened is a fan sitting directly above the Yankees dugout, right behind Aaron Boone, seems to have shouted something at Hunter Wendelstadt, which is probably something that is happening all the time. Fans yelling at umpires sitting near home plate. That's fine. And Hunter Wendelstadt heard after he had just warned Aaron Boone and said, I can't hear anything else from you for the rest of the day or you're gone. And he ejected him. Aaron Boone comes out and we can hear him very clearly being like, I didn't say anything. What is going on? Brad Ausmus is pointing at the fan who yelled and says, it was him. It was a very juvenile scene all around. And that is how Aaron Boone's day concluded five pitches into the game on Monday.
Just delightful. Now, yes. I kind of wish the Yankees had won this game so that, you know, you could really joke about, like, so that Aaron Boone could have been jovial about it afterwards instead of being understandably butthurt, right, because they lost 2-0. Like, it, that is the type of game where Aaron Boone probably feels like, oh, if I had been in there, I could have pulled those levers and
sure. Led well, the not crew against to Mason Miller. I don't think anybody was going to beat Mason Miller that day. But to your point, you know, Aaron Boone after the game says, this was embarrassing. This is embarrassing. For, you know, like this is silly. I want to get into, I know you want to get into Aaron Boone's ejection reputation, which is really spectacular. I really want to dig into Hunter Wendelstadt's response and Hunter Wendelstadt as a character. But I want you to go first. I want you to talk about Aaron Boone and his seemingly, you know, superhuman ability to get ejected, whether he deserves it or not.
He is our active heave-ho king. Through 894 games managed, Boone has been ejected a whopping 35 times. Okay? For context, Dusty Baker, who is no longer managing, who spent thousands of games in the big leagues, was only ejected 26 times. So Dusty, 26 ejections in 4,046 games. Aaron Boone, 35 ejections in 894 games. And so Boone is right up there on like the all-time list in terms of like ejections per games managed.
4%.
Like how often...
Like 4% of his games.
4% of his games.
It is unreal.
3.91% of his games, he is given the hook. So if you catch a four-game set with the Yankees, chances are you're going to get an Aaron Boone ejection, which is a wild way to think about it, right?
Like, I would be curious what his home road splits are.
Okay.
I feel like he's often getting ejected at home.
Yep.
But anyway, so yeah.
He's up, just to be clear, he's up there with the GOATs already. Like, this is already an unbelievable resume.
Yeah.
I would probably say, just to, you know, shouts out some of the others, Earl Weaver was a real king at this. 96 ejections in 2,541 games.
Like, you think about what it takes to get ejected, and I'd be curious what the ejection rates are over time in general, if umps, certainly feels like it now, but it's certainly more magnified. We're seeing all these things on social media. We're actually watching every game. Yeah.
Sorry. I phrased that incorrectly. Math was very much off, very off earlier when I said that if you go to a four game set, you'll probably get the same ejected. That is bad math. Bad math. My apologies.
Thank you for addressing that. I want to talk about, to your point though, like I don't know if ejections are up or down. Historically, like if the league-wide ejection rate is higher than it was 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years ago, I'm honestly not sure. But Aaron Boone is here. I mean, he's leading the charge at the very least.
What I'm most curious about with Boone specifically is being the manager of the Yankees is a different job than being the manager of the 29 other teams. Hmm. And I am curious how much of this is Boone fulfilling his destiny as the Yankees manager, where if you are the Yankees manager, fans want to see that you care and that you are fired up as much as all those millions of Yankees fans out in the world, right? Or was Boone hired as the Yankees manager because that quality was seen in him and he was brought in as a result? Or how much of it is him growing into the responsibilities of the role? I think that Aaron Boone crushing the ejection rate as manager of the Yankees is not a coincidence. Like, I really do believe that. And I think that it is the kind of the superiority complex that goes with being part of the Yankee land, which, again, is totally valid. 27 rings. They make more money than any other franchise. They're the most popular and most important franchise in the sport. And that comes with a level of gravitas, a level of gravitas that Aaron Boone embodies in the way that he is like, you're wrong about this call. Buzz off. Like, I am in charge, you're wrong, eject me if you want, and I have no notes about it. Now, there is maybe a conversation, like, is there a point where Aaron Boone starts pissing umpires off enough that, like, they start taking it out on the players? I don't know if we're there yet. I would be skeptical.
So this is a good transition to what happened here, because obviously what we are discussing today it's absurd that Aaron Boone got ejected. But let's go to Hunter Wendelstedt, because before we get to who Hunter Wendelstedt is, I wanted to talk about what he said after the game. So this is from Brian Hoke. I believe this was more than just a pool report, but he definitely gave a pretty lengthy answer. But I'm just going to read some of these quotes here. Hunter Wendelstedt said he heard something from the area of the dugout rather than determine who said it. Quote, Aaron Boone is the manager of the New York Yankees and is responsible for everything that happens in the dugout. I don't want to eject a ball player. We need to keep them in the game. That's what the fans pay to see. Aaron Boone runs the Yankees. He got ejected. Pause. Thank you, Hunter Wendelstedt. We have to give him credit here. Amidst this horrifically embarrassing situation, this is an acknowledgement and an interesting mindset here that I appreciate from an umpire, obviously, and something we would like to see more often from more umpires, which is that he is saying, listen, I don't want to eject players because that is the point of why we are all here.
No one is buying tickets to watch Aaron Boone sit on the top step of the dugout and ponder whether he's going to Marinaccio or Ian Hamilton.
Exactly.
That is not why fans come to the yard.
Exactly. And so an umpire directly stating that is good. Now, the concept that Aaron Boone is responsible for his dugout is interesting, especially when, as from what we can tell, it did not come from the dugout. But we get more from Hunter Wendelstedt. Quote, apparently what he said was there was a fan right above the dugout. This isn't my first ejection. In the entirety of my career, I've never ejected a player or a manager for something a fan has said. I understand it's going to be part of the story or something like that because that's what Aaron was portraying. I heard something coming from the far end of the dugout, had nothing to do with his area, but he's the manager of the Yankees, so he's the one that had to go. This seems to suggest, despite all of the video evidence that we have seen, that he heard something else that we cannot necessarily see on the other end of the dugout. We can call BS on that. That's fine. The video is what it looks like, which is he responds as soon as the fan sitting behind Aaron Boone yells something. Regardless of all of that, I want to get into the notion of you're responsible for everybody in your dugout, because that I do think if he is talking about who's in the dugout and like, I'd rather eject you than anybody else. Again, that's better, right? If I'd rather, and I'm sure players would agree that they want to feel like, yeah, I can yell, I can chirp at the ump because actually my manager is more likely to get ejected than I am. That's part of the manager standing up for their players, right? However, as Hunter Wells says, saying this isn't my first ejection, we're going to get to his track record here in a second. This is why it's so funny, right? Because this is such a basic interaction that you would think could have conceivably happened before. Fans are yelling all the time. We see them right behind home plate yelling all the time. And remember, umpires can also eject fans. That is something that happens sometimes too, and that is not what has happened here. And so that's why I'm so fascinated by this interaction, because it does not seem to be a unique situation of a fan behind the dugout yelling and an umpire ejecting someone for it.
If Wendelstedt had owned up to this mistake.
Right. This is the problem.
Because yes. I think maybe Hoke did report this, that Wendelstedt had yet to watch the video. At the point where they had spoken.
I imagine he has by now, but this was right after the game. Right? Yeah.
I actually don't really blame him too much for the mistake. Like, he should be able to determine between Aaron Boone's voice and a fan's voice. And it seems like he does understand that Aaron Boone was not the one who said the thing that caused for Aaron Boone to get ejected, right?
Yes.
And I think that this particular context where the fan is sitting alone in the front row, there's like no one around the fan. And it's like, it's a perfect level of, okay, most fans will say something crazy and like long. It's clear that this fan is like, that's enough, Blue, or like, be better. It sounded like the type of chirp that would come from a dugout. So I think Hunter Wendelstedt accidentally ejecting a manager for something a fan did is bad, but not like incomprehensible.
Yeah. It is embarrassing, is a good word.
It is embarrassing. But he's got to look at the video and accept fault. That is, I think, what pisses me off and what pisses Boone off and what pisses Yankees fans off is the lack of accountability here when it comes to Wendelstedt.
Yes. This is the bigger theme of just like our issues with umpires now, I think, in general, is the lack of accountability, the fact that there's no repercussions, the fact that it's basically just like they get to just decide like, nope, this is the reality and we just have to suck it up and move on. And that is certainly a frustrating part of this. But, you know, for Hunter Wendelstedt, like this is why this is such an interesting thing. And he says, it's not my first ejection. Yeah, it's not. I mean, how much do you know about the name Wendelstedt?
The Wendelstedts are like the Kennedys, baby.
So Hunter Wendelstedt is the son of Harry Wendelstedt, who umped for like 40 years, beginning in the 60s. They are actually the only father-son duo to ever umpire in a major league game, which is absolutely incredible. Harry, his father, passed away a number of years ago. But again, this is like a legendary umpiring family, to the point where the basically premier umpiring school is called the Harry Wendell Stent School of Umpiring, Umpire School, okay, which was renamed after he had taken it over from some other previous umpires, and which brings me to just my last topic.
And Harry Wendell Stent, you know, really pioneered the chainsaw strike three, apparently. That was like, he was like a big, which, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's, oh my gosh. It's like, again, this is, think about how many just umpiring, just things that I'm sure have come from this family. So this is the opposite of like an inexperienced guy. Like, this is, he's seen it all, right? However, what I just have to bring to your attention is, if you could pull up the Harry Wendell Stent Umpire School Wikipedia page, I just would like to marvel at the logo for this umpire school, because it is just so spectacular. I don't know whoever came up with this idea to make this be the logo. It just fires me up so much.
Are you talking about the plate?
Well, the it's the HW looking like an umpire is just is an incredibly creative look. So what my point is that Wendell Stent being this name, Wendell Stent being associated with this hilarious umpire controversy, is both so fitting and also extra goofy, because in theory, this should be the top. Now, listen, we have other things to tell us. Hunter Wellstat, as he went on to call it Balls and Strikes on Monday, is over the last 2 years, ump scorecards, like bottom five balls and strikes umpires.
So guy needs to go back to school.
That's disappointing. That's disappointing. Hopefully what we're living. I'm just imagining, you know, the next young umps that go to Harry Wendell Stent umpire school, they get there and they're all cracking jokes. Be like, all right, when did we learn how to eject umps, or how to eject managers for what fans say?
I want to go to the Pat Hoberg School of Umpire.
Yes. And
if you listen to this pod, you know that Jake and Jordan are like, we're up defenders generally. Like, we think that
balance it out. We're trying to balance it out.
It's disproportionate. Like, bad umpiring is bad, and Angel Hernandez is a joke, and whatever. But also, like, when Pat Hoberg has a day, like, that needs to be appreciated.
And I'm glad you mentioned that. I've been kind of saving to bring this up. Pat Hoberg, yet to call balls and strikes this year. This is something I've been watching. Again, umpires have injuries, so this is a thing that's it's possible. Angel Hernandez was out for a lot of last season with an injury, and then he came back, lucky for all of us. So I don't know. I hope Hoberg is doing okay, but he has not called a game yet this year. So I'm hope we could see him behind the plate at some points here soon.
Enough ump chat.
Let's move
on. Ump chat, you're out of here.
Yes, you're gone.
I got to say, getting ejected, as someone who has been ejected, at least from a college game, it's a crazy rush, dude. Like, it's like getting sent to timeout when you're a kid, or like going – the best comp is really like going to the principal's office or going to sent to detention in the middle of class, because everyone is watching you. Like, you are
– and like having to stop what's happening to make sure that you're not there anymore. That's happened to me in some classes in our middle school days.
Yeah, Jake and Jordan, we were in middle school detention together a couple of times. I once got in trouble because I tried to convince a teacher that I didn't need to go to school, I didn't need to go to class one day because it was a family tradition for me to have like a bris before my bar mitzvah. My family like waited.
Wow, until like right before the bar mitzvah. That's wild. And the teacher I imagine
the teacher saw through my ploy and sent me right to detention.
That is where you belong. All right, Jake, let's move on to our other main topic for today. And, you know, maybe the timing's a little bit weird here. You know, the Orioles did lose last night to the Angels. Angels breaking their losing streak as Mike Trout hits his first leadoff home run in over 10 years. More on that a little bit later. But the Baltimore Orioles rolled out a lineup last night that was kind of what they've been working towards for a long time. And I sent out a tweet about it, basically marveling at the fact that they have seven homegrown players plus Grayson Rodriguez on the mound. But really, it's funny because Ryan O'Hearn is batting third and Anthony Santander, who is probably like quietly one of the greatest Rule 5 picks of all time at this point, which is not really mentioned often when we talk about him. But that is it's just an incredible organizational kind of point for them to get to. This is, of course, because they just called Heston Kerstad back up as Austin Hayes goes on the IL. Henderson, Rutschman, O'Hearn, Santander, Mullins, Kowser, Westberg, Kerstad, and Jackson Holliday batting ninth. Jackson Holliday continues to struggle. He did get his second hit last night, so that's nice to see, but he is still having a batting average that is not what it is supposed to be when you're the number one prospect. However,
start with a zero.
Yeah, so that's not great. However, that was another piece of discourse that was kind of foisted upon us yesterday after Sam Blum of The Athletic wrote a very reasonable piece talking to Jackson Holliday and some of the Orioles coaches being like, hey, dude, you're 1-for-30. Like, that's probably weird for you because you've never been bad at baseball.
Yeah, let me do Holliday quickly.
Yeah,
there's a difference between being concerned about something and something being notable. Like, I think that Holiday's slow start is not reason to panic, right? Nor is it really reason quite yet to rethink how the industry feels about him as a player over the long haul. Like, he's 20. However, it is certainly notable that a guy who has always been good at the activity is being bad at the activity in such a way and to such an extent that he has been abysmal. He's not just been bad. Like, he is swinging through pitches in the zone. He has two hits. He looks awful. That's notable. That's worth asking him and the coaching staff about. And I thought that Sam did a good job.
And so I thought that Jackson Holliday did a good job of answering the questions thoughtfully, you know, and the coaches addressing it and being like, yeah, this is new. This is new. Of course, everyone deals with stuff at certain points. But to pretend like he's not 1-for-30 with a 50% strikeout rate is what I mean. It's fine. Like, we're all grownups here. We can talk about what we're seeing. It's not everything is a hit piece. It's just acknowledging a thing that is happening that is interesting. If honestly, anybody goes 1-for-30 in the big leagues with the 50% strikeout rate, like, you're probably going to notice it. It does not happen to that many big leaguers. That degree of struggle.
Do you know what Jackson Holliday could use, though? Is a couple more hit pieces. Get it?
That's true. He's actually would love some anything that has hit in it. I think he will actually take at this point. That is a great, 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 great point. But the other larger thing that we wanted to kind of get into is, you know, I tweeted about this lineup saying, oh, look at all these homegrown guys. This is an incredible organizational achievement. And I truly believe that. And there were some people responding being like, well, yeah, duh, they tanked. So obviously you tank. You have this happen. It's that simple. You do that, and then then eventually you have the lineup full of star level players that you drafted with the first pick overall. That's obviously what happens. To which we are here to say, again, sometimes I wonder, like, is it even worth responding to this kind of discourse? But I think it is interesting because I do think that the concept of tanking and how kind of casual fans react to it, especially for teams like the Orioles, who have gone from these depths to these heights so quickly. And of course, we saw it with Houston. And of course, Michael Elias involved with both. I understand why this is part of it, but I think we really wanted to just talk a little bit about why that is so unfair and which parts of it are valid and which parts of it are kind of ridiculous.
As somebody who watched a lot of the bad Orioles, okay, it was an embarrassment. It was an abomination. Those teams, particularly on the pitching side, were so undermanned in like an intentional way that made the experience of watching them unbearable. Because like there would be days where, you know, Renato Nunez and Jonathan Villar would have like awesome showings at the plate, and then like a terrible bullpen would blow it. And like that was really disheartening and would get exhausting and would make you not want to watch. And I think to some extent, there is something to an extended period of losing in that way, turning off certain members of a fan base, even once you get good again. Like, I do believe that that's true. However, I think it's important for the Orioles context, like, to lay out the timeline of tanking. They were bad in 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. That's 5 years of being bad. They were, like, surprising and spunky in 22, right? They entered 17 coming off a wild card appearance, trying to win. and they were like, I think they won 77 games off the top of my head. 75 mm-hmm. games. 18 when they won 47 games.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to be good that year. They signed Alex Cobb for money. They still had Manny Machado and Jonathan Scope and Kevin Gausman. Like, that team intended to compete. They just were bad at doing that. That's a different thing, right? Like, being bad at assembling a competitive baseball team is different than tanking. Like, it also deserves scorn and yeah. criticism, but it is not tanking. The 2018 Orioles did not tank. At that deadline, they traded off Machado and Scope and Gausman and all those guys because, like, they were on pace to win 47 games and those guys were going to be free agents, and so they traded them away. I don't think anything that the 2018 Orioles did deserves to be included in the tanking conversation. However,
yes,
19, 20, 21, that was tanking. They tanked up a storm. They were bad on purpose, okay? And I think that there were aspects of that experience that really stunk that I think back on as someone who cared about watching those games and was like, wow, that was embarrassing. Why did we do that? I wish we could have done it another way, okay? That is true. What is also true, that said tanking gave them top picks and more money to spend in the draft. That is all true, right? However, to this point, on Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, the Baltimore Orioles nailed those picks. There have been so many franchises that have risen and fallen, that have gone to the tanking depths and have drafted very poorly and have developed insufficiently, okay? Pick a team. They've probably done it at some point, right? And the Orioles have just been so good at identifying the right players and developing those players that deserves to be commended as much as the tanking itself deserves to be scorned, because it's not as if the Orioles director of player development picked up the phone and said, let's lose and save money over the next 3 years. No. The low A pitching coach, that person's job is to develop the baseball players. And mm-hmm. they have been superb at that to this point. One last thing. Adley Rutschman, number one overall pick. When you have it, like, they could have picked Bobby Witt and that would have looked great too, right? Like, that was yeah. a hard one to mess up. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
However, in the second round of that draft, they selected Gunnar Henderson, okay? Yeah. A player that all other 29 teams, there are probably some teams that didn't have picks that year.
But just clear. Most of the teams, he signs for $2.3 million with pick 42. There, you can find a lot of guys that signed for exactly that or near that, picked before right. him or right after him, teams that could have taken Gunnar Henderson.
That one is a humongous. I mean, he's going to finish top five in MVP, right? Like, he is one of the best players in the league. He is 22 now, I believe. And he could have been any teams, right? And the Orioles identified it. They developed him. That he has been more impactful and better this season than Adley Rutschman.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
And like, no doubt. Every single organization would rather.
Since last year. I mean, yeah. I mean, like, right. he's been right there and just as good.
Exactly. And that's a player that anybody could have had, right? Holiday, yes, number one overall pick. Hurstad, yes, number two overall pick. Those guys haven't come up and done anything. And I think that that is what is important about the Orioles specifically. Yes, they tanked. Yes, that's helped them. The outfield that helped them win 101 games last year was Austin Hayes, Cedric Mullins, and Anthony Santander. Three guys who were they were the starting lineup of the 2020 and 2021 Orioles who sucked, right? The same outfield. So that is development at the big league level, right? Ryan O'Hearn, who has been the Orioles, I guess, second best hitter behind Colton Cowser so far, like, they just picked him up off the scrap heap, right?
They got him for cash from a terrible team in Kansas City right. who, you know, it's not like they couldn't use some good hitters around. And they're like,
right. Oh. Like, Kyle Bradish was the guy they traded for, right? There are elements of this that make me, as someone who loves the Orioles, like, uncomfortable that they bottomed out to get here, but it's not that easy. You don't just press the tank button and end up with a division title. Like, you have to hit on so many things, and they have. And the last point that I know Jordan's about to make is the Orioles ain't even shit yet. Okay.
They haven't done anything. Like, people are like, because we've been hearing so much about obviously what they did last year, but then also just like that they're the best farm system. I think that's what kind of makes people upset, is they're so tired about hearing about all their prospects that they assume they got from just tanking, even though they didn't, because guys like Kobe Mayo was a fourth round pick. Like, all these guys they got from all these different places. But why are we doing this discourse before they've won a single playoff game? They got embarrassed at home last year in October. Of course, we think they're one of the best teams in baseball again, and it is because of all these things that have come together. But this is crazy. This is not like – this is the discourse that you do after they steamroll the postseason with this lineup. That's the opposite of what happened. This lineup I was just talking about just lost to the Angels last night. That's fine. Like, baseball's hard. They got a long way to go. And Mike Elias will tell you that they haven't accomplished what to get here is astounding. And that's why we want to give them credit, because building up a team like this quickly is amazing. It's really, really, really impressive. And so that is the point we are making. There's so much farther ahead of us to go. And, you know, if all of these guys end up being all-stars, that could be a different conversation. But the chances are they won't, right? And there's still a long way to go for all these players individually and collectively. And we will see how far they can actually take the Orioles, because it is not that simple. This team might be awesome. They might win 100 games for the next 5 years and never make it to the World Series, because that's what baseball is.
Also, there have been many teams throughout the timeline of baseball who lost a lot of games, got a bunch of good players, and then they got good. Like, have you heard of Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg, two generational number one overall picks who double-handedly helped the Nationals alongside top 10 pick Anthony Rendon, you know, to get to the playoffs every year? Like, this happens all the time. D.L. Hall was a late first-round pick. Joey Ortiz was a fourth-round pick. Package those two guys to get together to go get Corbin Burns. Like, that's an accomplishment. That's a win, right? A win not necessarily brought on by tanking. Again, tanking is bad. I don't recommend doing it. I don't recommend enduring it. It's not fun. It sucks. It sucks because you part of the fugazi of being a sports fan is believing that everyone is always trying their best, right? And the players, even the players on tanking teams, are trying their best, right? But when there is someone who is not trying their best and that person is the person pulling the levers atop the organization, it kind of breaks the fourth wall in this really uncomfortable way. And I don't want to say that tanking is – I'm not saying tanking is good or that tanking like works 100% and that baseball as a sport should set up structures that avoid tanking in the way that the Orioles did. But in this specific context, I think it's more sophisticated and more complex than people give it credit for. That's all I have to say. Jordan Schusterman, let's take a break so I can blow my nose, get some pollen out of my sinuses. When we return, we'll be back with something that we haven't planned yet. And welcome back to Baseball Barbecast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. We discussed the pollen at the beginning of the show. And in the last 2 minutes during the break, I sneezed so much that my nose is bleeding. Patch me up. Get me back in there. The show must go on. Cut it out.
You'll be fine.
If Tristan McKenzie could pitch through a torn UCL, I can podcast with a nosebleed.
What we are going to do in the second half is we're going to read some of your emails. This is long overdue. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. And we are going to read four emails today. We're gonna definitely save and do in the future. I want to do a little bit more research on those. But let's read some emails, Jake. It's been a while. Let's first begin with Reese. Not Reese Hoskins, different Reese. Spelled the same. Reese says, "Hi guys. I was interested in your segment about baseball fielding compared to cricket." Yes, this is something we talked about recently, where the BBC account tweeted out a Cedric Mullins catch, and all those cricket fans were like, "Who cares? He's wearing a glove." Reese continues. That was my sorry note there. Reese continues. "It's something I've thought about quite a bit as I follow baseball from a country, New Zealand, that has a lot of cricket and Zippo baseball. As much as I like baseball, even after a few years following the White Sox and then the Angels, it's hard to see how the fielding compares to cricket."
Wrong teams. You picked the wrong teams, Reese.
That's true. "Other than the catcher and perhaps the shortstop, the baseball fielders are big lugs with strong arms. I don't think they are unathletic, but the fact is they cannot get into MLB if they can't hit with power that cricketers couldn't match," as he points, okay? "And so they are really big guys, more like rugby than cricket players." Interesting. He continues, While the cricketers can't hit with the power of the big leaguers, they can catch without a glove, or they wouldn't have made it to the top of the game to start with. There's no chance a baseball player could field in the slips alongside the wicketkeeper, the catcher equivalent, catching edges of the bat without gloves. 9 out of 10 catches in cricket are better than those in baseball simply because you have to catch a ball, which is hard as a rock, and do it without a glove. Love the show. Hope you're enjoying the Switch to Yahoo. Cheers, Reese. We are enjoying our Switch to Yahoo. Thanks, Reese. Oh,
we are happy. Two things. If you've ever been around a professional rugby player, that is not what a baseball player looks like. I understand the idea that they are bigger and luggier because they have to hit with power, but there are like 10 baseball players who are built like rugby players. Tyler O'Neill is one. Like, but rugby dudes don't have
Reyes
necks.
Reyes Maranta is built like
those guys player. Don't have necks. Like, they look like Clinton Portis. Yes. Okay, that's the body comp. Now, I also agree that cricketers are more slight and wiry than most baseball players. Like, but I think there's a muscularity that's like in between those two extremes. That's just my first thought. Second thought is cricket, the rules of cricket, like, are such that a catch is exceedingly more rare than a catch in baseball. Mm-hmm. And so when the equivalent of like a fly out happens in cricket, it's emotionally the equivalent of a home run. And so I think that cricket fans, not quite a home, it's equivalent of like
that, but that's fine. It's
I'm trying to think of an example. It's a big deal. Like, it is a cause for celebration to the point that a routine fly out to left, no one is like losing their mind over that. Okay. And I think that what that does is it colors cricket catches in a slightly different light by the people who are watching them all the time, that like they're inherently more enjoyable, right? I also do agree that not having a glove makes certain plays more impressive. I just think this is like a very typical beer and tacos debate where it's like, both of these things are cool. Yes. Why are we trying to argue what's better?
I agree with that. My main thing is something that Reese gets at here is that they're bigger and stronger and they hit the ball harder. It's not an accident that they're wearing gloves in baseball. It's because catching baseballs that are hit at very, very high velocities, velocities that are higher than what cricket, you know, balls are being hit at, it's harder. And so, like, I'm sorry. Is it explicitly harder whether you're wearing a glove or not? But it's not an accident. Like, they're wearing gloves for reasons, because trying to feel the ball. And listen, again, I watch a lot of cricket and I see how hard they... I would love to know more about specifically exit velocity, because again, I just don't, what's hard hit? Like, you know, it's 95 miles an hour in baseball. What is that in cricket? I don't know. So I think both are, but yeah, I think he's getting at it. That's the thing. It's just, not only is it a different kind of ball, whether they're both hard, like, it's just being hit so much harder. And so that's why they're wearing gloves, but it's fine. I love cricket. And I am totally understanding of Reese defending cricket defense, because it is great. So to your point, we should enjoy all of it.
Our next email is from Ethan. Ethan says, Jake and Jordan, if the World Series champion goes to the White House, where does the team with the worst record go? Basically, what is the lowest ranking government office? I was thinking the Mosquito Abatement District, a local thing we have here in California. But I think you'll have better ideas. Thanks, Ethan. So a couple things here. I love the idea of all 30 teams have to make a visit to some sort of government office every year based upon the previous season's results. Okay. Like, if the champ goes to the White House, like, the runner up goes to the Naval Observatory where the VP lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, that's the second level. Mm-hmm. Like, playoff team gets to go to the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there are certain levels here. There is meaning and purpose in all lines of work. Okay. That's important to establish here. But where would you send the 2024 White Sox?
I think it's a very easy answer, because, and I think this qualifies as a government office, you send them to the DMV. That's your punishment. If you're the worst team in baseball, you better go get in line and wait for an hour and a half to renew your license. I think that everybody, the whole roster, and by the way, the other funny thing about this is that these visits happen the year after. Right? For the most part, it's not like they don't do it immediately after. It's not like, okay, you do the parade, you do Disney World, and then you go to the White House. That's another funny version if we did it that way. But the idea of like how many of the worst teams in baseball, like how many of those players are still on that team the next season is part of the funny part of this, because, you know, the World Series team, a lot of the guys are probably sticking around and they get to go to the White House. But I don't know. I think the DMV,
I think the worst team should go to the DMV. You know, like air traffic controller is probably not a thing that we should be sending non-qualified people to go do.
What is that? Is that a government office? I mean, I don't know if it's the FAA. By the way, I'm still hoping we get an update on the Rockies FAA situation soon. Our next email comes from Leo. Leo says, "Hi, Jake and Jordan. I write to you today in immense anger at our institutions that we are supposed to be able to trust. As I watched Rangers and Braves on Sunday Night Baseball, I took note of Wyatt Langford's exceptional speed. The speed took me off guard because I don't remember it being a big selling point for him. Sure enough, I looked at a popular prospect ranking site, which will remain nameless, and saw that he was rated with only 55 grade speed. Quite mid, I think we can all agree. Then I go over to Baseball Savant and I see that this man is in the top 98th percentile of sprint speed. That is extremely fast. I checked Fangraphs and saw that certified ball knower Eric Longenhagen had a sizzling 70 grade on Langford speed. So clearly his wheels were not a mystery. I'm writing to express my anger and confusion more than anything, but my question is, how can professionals get something so objective, such as speed, this wrong? Why should I listen to these prospect rankers other than Eric? When I see such a poorly thought out grade, I understand not being able to perfectly project a hit tool, but Jackson Churio was given a 70 grade speed by these nameless rankers and is only in the top 80th percentile of sprint speed on Savant. So they just looked at these two guys and were like, oh, the slower guy is faster. Am I missing something here? I know I have no reason to be mad about this, but I am anyway. So any light you might be able to shed on this would be a big help. All the best, Leo." I love this email so much.
Can I just say, I have no reason to be mad about this, but I am. This is exactly the type of like minutia thing that Jordan just gets so pissed off and passionate about. So Leo, you being mad about this, like, this is very relatable to Mr. Schusterman.
And this specific example is something that like is kind of up my alley and something I've noticed before, that like speed grades in the minors are all over the place. And sometimes a lot of that is you just shrug and say, hey, he's kind of fast, hey, he's kind of slow, 45, 55, right? We're talking about the 20 to 80 scale. But it is funny that now we have these, since we have StatCast in the big leagues, right? Yes, you have scouts that are doing their stopwatch when guys run to first base at varying levels of effort. But the truth is, we don't have sprint speed actual measurements until you get to the major leagues. This is not something, I mean, I guess we probably do have Hawk. I actually do wonder if this stuff is being tracked, player tracking in the minors, and it's just not public. But I just think this is an example of like, you just aren't actually seeing in the same way. And because of how players look, sometimes scouts just botch this. This is something that happens all the time. And it is fascinating to me too, because of now that we can measure it, we just decide. So to me, I would say, don't worry about speed grades on these prospect sites too much, because if they get to the major leagues, you will know a lot faster, pun intended, than anything you're going to read on any prospect site, even if it is our dear friend Eric Longenhagen.
But it's also like, okay, here's another example of this. Like, Jarrett Jones's fastball, right? Like, it's clear that Jarrett Jones of the Pittsburgh Pirates, it's at least a 70 fastball, right? At least.
Oh, yeah.
And people are very hesitant to put 70s on anything ever, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because
that's
let alone 80s. Yeah. And so what I would say about like an example that I just, like the one I just provided, like, unless it is obvious, people are uncomfortable standing out on a limb for it, which I get, right?
Especially if the unnamed prospect site, you know, which may or may not be MLB Pipeline, you are not going to see a lot of 70 grades in any pipeline report. You're going to see a range, right? And like, that's the thing with stuff like this that is objective. Just be patient. We're going to find out. You'll know, especially for guys that are literally in the big leagues this quickly. So, it is funny.
Just quickly on Jarrett Jones. Like,
oh yeah,
I'm now looking at Fangraphs, and you know, like they put a 60 on Jarrett Jones's fastball. It's like, that's a 70. It's definitely a 70,
right?
Right. Sometimes you just miss stuff. Sometimes stuff ticks up. Sometimes things change, right?
Yeah.
But I think that Leo is right and that speed feels like something. Like, why Langford did not just go from a 55 runner to a 80 runner over the last 3 months, right? Like, that is...
He's been fast, and some people were more able to see or understand that than others, and that happens. Our last email today comes from Zach. This is just a story that is so funny. Zach says, quick story from work yesterday. My client, I'm a barber. Oh, sick. Zach's a barber. Maybe Zach can make an appearance on the shop and cut.
Oh, Zach, let us know, are the cuts on the shop good?
Zach says, my client is planning his wedding in Jersey outside of Philly. He meets with a potential caterer. Caterer tells client about how they do events for 76ers and other sports people and includes an anecdote about doing an event for one of Tiger Woods' friends. Quote. She says, a baseball player. Have you heard of Mike Trout? Goes on to tell how she mistook Mr. Trout for a delivery driver at his own home.
Okay, two things about that. Number one, yes, face looks like a delivery driver.
He could be
anybody. If you see Mike Trout standing up and moving through space, wow, that's an athletic delivery driver.
Zach continues, the fact that the name, face, and reputation of Mike Trout has failed to break through to the public consciousness to this degree underscores what you guys occasionally talk about in your show. It's hard to tell from inside the baseball bubble. Anyway, it made me laugh. Hope it make you laugh. It did make me laugh. I love the show. I recommend it to nearly every baseball fan at the barbershop. Oh, thank you, Zach. That fires me up.
I'm going to have to go.
The real takeaway from this. Oh, he's listed as what his barbershop is. We can give him a plug. Old Bank Barbers. So to this point, though, actually, I don't know. Is Zach local in – is he in the New Jersey, Philly area?
I believe this is actually in Baltimore.
Okay. Well, there you go. He does say let's go O's at the end of his
– So, yeah, I believe this is in Baltimore. So, and this is like kind of near where my mom grew up. So I will go check it out next time I'm in Baltimore.
My favorite part about the story is when he's citing the caterer who's explaining like, oh, yeah, it's Mike Trout. He says, a baseball player. Have you heard of Mike Trout? No, Mike Trout's the baseball player.
He's one of the baseball players.
What's concerning to me is that this was somebody in Mike Trout's area that had felt the need to like be like, oh, maybe you've heard of this guy.
This is someone Millville adjacent.
That's disappointing. Now, that said, too, like that Mike Trout is like one of Tiger Woods' friends. I don't think we've talked about this on this edition of our podcast, but Mike Trout is currently building his own golf course with Tiger Woods, which is like one of the most... We don't care about golf at all. And that is like an all-time rich person flex that I've ever heard. And it is tremendous.
I would say so. I was having this conversation with someone recently. It's like rich people saving money is the worst thing. Rich people donating money is the best thing. Mm-hmm. But in between that is rich people spending money, which is way better than rich people saving money. Yeah. Right. And so for Mike Trout to be like, I'm going to spend some of my $425 million contract on my own golf course with Tiger Woods?
Yeah.
No,
I'm
going to
build a golf course.
No notes.
Yeah. Hey, Tiger Woods, can you come build a golf course in my backyard in Millville, New Jersey?
Sure.
But to be clear, this will be available to. It's not like only Mike Trout can play on it, but it's great.
I would go.
One of my favorite Trout things.
I would do that. I've played one round of golf in my entire life. And I would go.
And let's hope the second one is on Mike Trout's golf course.
It will only be nowhere else.
To that point, let's end the pod here. The only other topic we wanted to hit was the Giants light show. This is something we talked about on a recent show.
I was early on this. I was early on the light show. I came up on. I said they did the light show. They didn't have any home runs, so they.
So it was they had it for the home runs, right? They have all these new fancy LEDs. It seems what they were really gearing up for was for the Camilo Doval save opportunity. We're blowing out the closer entrances, which is great. That's fine. However, the clip of this sparked a totally different concern and conversation, which is that as part of the beginning of this light show, the lights go out, which would be fine in the event that Camilo Doval was done throwing baseballs in the bullpen at high speeds. However, the clip that was shared many times on social media, that was not the case. Because what you see is Camilo Doval warming up in the bullpen. He winds up for his final pitch. He unleashes it, and then the lights go out like some sort of horror movie.
It was like he threw the ball against the electric box, like the switchboard.
Leaving people to wonder, is the catcher okay? To which, thankfully...
Jordan, whenever there is any bullpen catcher content, the odds... And we talked about this on the last show. The odds of the bullpen catcher being a character in the extended Cespedes Family Barbecue universe are like 50-50. And that was the case in this instance with Alex Berg, who we watched, I believe, hit a ball like 435 feet for a home run in the minor leagues. I want to say it was in Hickory, North Carolina, potentially. This is like, we watched him play ball multiple times in the minor leagues.
No, it was in High Desert. Alex Berg is a wild story, as any bullpen catcher goes, whatever. The point is he was a catcher in the minor leagues. He was with Texas. He was with Texas when he was like 27. He was like the oldest player in the California League in 2015. I remember talking to him and we were like, this guy's great. He's got 1,000 OPS. He's 27 in A-ball and he's just a character. Of course, this is a guy that goes on to become a bullpen catcher, one of their catching coaches. He's 36 now. And thankfully, we have some reporting that Alex is doing just fine. Now, he did say that like it was scary and dangerous, and thankfully Camilo Doval absolutely spotted up and you know hit the glove with a four seamer. In the event that he was throwing something that moved a little bit more, this could have been very bad.
It's night night.
But thankfully, now at the very and thankfully, hopefully, this is a lesson that is learned for the Giants ballpark ops. Let's wait until Mr. Doval has left the bullpen. Let us see him take steps out, down the steps, through the door before we cut the lights off.
This was a very high stakes version of when the light switch to your bedroom is by the door and you turn it off and then you have to walk through the dark to your bed and you're completely reliant on how clean your bedroom is. Like whether or not you hurt yourself by tripping over something and you like move very slowly throughout the room. You know, you feel like a total dodo. Yeah, great that's call. What that was. You got to have the bedside light, though.
So shout out to Alex Berg. It seems like we will make that adjustment as the Giants got that win. All right, Jake, let's be done. We had a couple other topics. Maybe we'll work it into Good, Bad, Ugly later this week. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. That Mike Trout, the baseball player who's friends with Tiger Woods, I have a piece about him coming out today that you can check out about how he is running again and how Ron Washington appropriately is treating him like he's a rookie again, now putting him in a leadoff spot, which is so great. He immediately homered last night, so that was fun. So look out for that piece today. Otherwise, I'll be in Cincinnati for Phillies Reds today, so we'll see what happens there. Hopefully bring some matzah to Ellie De La Cruz and Garrett Stubbs.
And, if you could get a picture of Ellie De La Cruz eating matzah, I mean, that's it, dude. That's all you need, right? Like,
dude, Ellie is just ridiculous right now. All right, we're done. Thank you all for listening. Email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com and we'll talk to you on Friday.